falsity and truth in teachers' unions, Obamacare, and the Boy Scouts. On Last Impressions 35, I'm Justin Katz. So it seemed like a theme of things this week, for me anyway, was just finding how false the picture is that's painted for the public. Sometimes I think not intentionally, sometimes it's spin from people with particular interests, like say a labor union that ought to be checked twice in their commentary by people reporting to the public, and the public ought to be skeptical as well. Sometimes it's, you know, it's the reporting itself, or just the ignorance of things that politicians or people in the public say. It makes you wonder how we're supposed to get a clear view of things. Before I enumerate some examples, I don't know if as somebody who follows news media pretty closely, you experience this as well. But you wonder, it feels like it's gotten worse. And you wonder whether it's gotten worse or just you're able to spot things more clearly. I mean, I know when I was younger, I believed a sort of fundamentally false view in high school. Into college, I was pretty liberal and had that, you know, through the looking glass experience of discovering that things I thought were just plainly true were actually plainly false. So maybe it's not getting worse. Maybe it is. It's hard to tell. Maybe, you know, like they say with time speeding up, you know, is it really? Is it like a quantum physics thing where time is actually speeding up? Or does our individual perception as you get older, you just time seems to speed up for you? For all you know, now I'm getting well into the, you know, college stoner conversation here. But, you know, how do you know that your perception of time is any more rapid than a child's perception of time right now? Maybe it's the same, that they have no experience of it seeming longer, whereas you do, you know. But anyway, where was I? Oh, so I don't know if it's a matter of knowing more stuff about how things work, and that makes me see how things are being falsely presented. There seems to be a general sense that, and I've said this myself, that the news media, entertainment media, others, partisan people are just not even interested in trying to hide things anymore. I know in Rhode Island, it definitely seems like the politicians just don't even care. It could be that I just started paying attention during a wave of actually caring, pretending to care, and it was always worse before. But anyway, one of the issues that got my mind in this jumbling direction was the Warwick Teachers Union has now closed down two schools for full school days with sick outs. Now, the union president denies that these were sick outs. They were actually sick teachers. I mean, in the first article I saw, and I posted on the current Ocean State Current on this, is that she claimed that, well, you know, that school is, you know, sickly. There are a lot of people are sick there. So it could literally be that a large majority of the teachers are out sick today. Then she kind of backpedaled when nobody would really buy that. And said, oh, well, you know, we didn't take a vote, so it's not an official sick day, so I can't say one way or the other. But, you know, it was a union action, pretty clearly, it seems to me. And so the Warwick Teacher Union, Darlene Netko, has been everywhere, you know, trying to get out their message about grievances with the school committee, which she claims that the school committee has violated their contract, but the contract expired 2 years ago and they haven't negotiated a new one. Yeah, I'll get to that in a moment. But to ease into this, here's one of those. She was on, this Darlene Netko was on WPRO with Gene Valicenti in the morning. And something that, it was a theme that went on throughout their conversation, but Gene Valicenti put something in a particular way that I think is worth pausing to consider.
Parents don't like this. People don't like this. Do you think you're going to bite the hand that feeds you or hasn't been feeding you for 2.5 years, whatever it is?
Now, that's a reasonable, good question. Is this action that upsets people, is this going to end up hurting your union's cause? But he was playing there on something she had said in their conversations, making it sound like the teachers are dedicated, they're working without a contract. For 2 years, they're working without a contract. And, you know, hey, they've gotten paid. For the most, that part of their contract has continued on. You know, it's not like Valicenti here kind of reinforced, in a joking way, granted, but it reinforced what she had been spinning earlier, was this sense that, you know, working without a contract is some kind of imposition on, you know, some sort of self-sacrificial charity. Teachers are braving the depredations of working without a contract. I mean, I posted in a current, these teachers, step 10, this after 10 years, you're making over $76,000 a year. And then plus thousands of dollars for longevity, plus thousands of dollars for any higher degrees or even courses if they haven't gotten to the higher degree yet, plus opportunity to watch detentions for money, to coach or run a club or so on and so forth. This is not hardship. To the extent that the school committee has, quote, violated the terms of the expired contract, it's not paying them. It hasn't stopped paying them. We're not in the days when an employer could force people to work without their earning anything or being able to feed themselves because they were deprived of their pay or forcing them to work in terrible, terrible, deadly conditions. We're not in those conditions, that world anymore. And yet here it is, working without a contract. The hand that isn't feeding you. The hand is feeding the union, okay? Can we make clear that point? Also, this woman, Darlene Netko, the union president in Warwick, was on with Matt Allen, also on WPRO. And here this starts to get more into the meat of what I opened up talking about. The issue at hand, Matt had her on to discuss and get clarity on their pay. So the Warwick teacher's contract allows up to 90 days of paid time off. Now, keep in mind that teachers work 180-day work year. So teachers can get full pay for up to 90 days, half of their entire work year. So there was some kind of confusion because some teachers had called in and say, we pay for that benefit and there's some formula. And Matt tried to make it clear, I think. But it wasn't. Certainly it wasn't to me until after I'd figured it out for myself and then listened to it again. But if you listen to Netko here, the union woman, she makes it sound like there's some fee that they have to pay each time they're out. So I'm out sick, I have to pay X. That's not correct. They don't pay for their sick time. They get their full pay. Their full pay at that 76,000 plus scale. If all teachers in a Warwick district take so much time off that they use up the money that has been set aside for substitutes, then they start having to contribute to a fund to pay the balance. So it's sort of like an insurance for the district. We will pay substitutes up to this amount, and above that, the teachers have to cover it. There's a formula so that the teachers who take off the most have to pay the most. What didn't make this clear on Matt Allen is he didn't apply any numbers to it. So if you read the contract, the school committee puts aside enough money, $401.56 for each teacher, and they pay substitutes $75 a day. So in essence, if you do the math, the fund is enough that every teacher could take about 5 1/3 days off sick time during this school year, this 180-day school year, which is more than a full work week. So every teacher could take that off and nobody would have to replenish anything. I took a look at InfoWorks, which is RIDE's, one of RIDE, the Rhode Island Department of Education's transparency pages. InfoWorks is good if you're just new to this kind of data. It quickly becomes, you know, not quite as helpful as other data sources that are more robust, but it's a good place to turn for, you know, quick numbers. So according to InfoWorks, Warwick has 951 teachers. So 401.56 times 951. This fund for substitute teachers is set at $381,865. Now continue the math out. That means that the teachers have to take off collectively 5,092 days of their 180-day work year and require substitutes for all those days, and then they have to chip in. So this is not, we're not talking like, you know, okay, we'll throw $100 into the pot, and after that's spent, the teachers have to start paying for it. This is, the teachers have to take off, all of them together, have to take off 5,092 work days. That's 5,092 classrooms that don't have their teacher in the room in 180-day work year. And then the teachers will start to have to pay by this formula. And if you never take a day off, you never pay, right? If you take it one day off, and one of the 5,092 days is you pay that proportion for the extra, right? I don't know. It's, that makes it seem a lot different, doesn't it? Then, oh, we pay for that benefit. No, you don't. No, you don't. It's been arranged that you get a full week of sick time, free and clear, but you kind of all have put into a sort of a risk pool, so to speak, in, to help out anybody who has a longer-term issue. And think about that, though. I did the math. I didn't write it down, so this is partly a guess, but I think it was 5,092 divided by 90, whatever it happens to be, something like 56 teachers could take off half of the year and still the pool would cover the money that's put aside would cover it. And then they would have to start chipping in. So this is not at all unreasonable to look at this thing and say, this is very generous, folks. This is a place where you could really start to shoulder a little bit more of the cost. Now, here's the insult to injury aspect of this. Because for these 2 days so far, enough teachers called in sick that they had to close schools, they didn't need any substitutes, right? So that's free and clear. Those, whatever, 100, some, well, the school was closed, it was all the teachers, something like 200-300 teachers got the day off for a union action. They'll be paid, provided they don't go over the 90 days, I suppose. And there's no substitutes, so they won't even have to pay that. This won't even come out of that pool. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, I guarantee you that the union folks, the folks in who are really involved orchestrating what the union does, know this stuff. They know how this works. They get the math and how it all fits together, but they just don't care because it's not about, it's about getting them more money. It's really not about, and power for their political activities. It's not about everybody getting around a table and coming to a reasonable conclusion. Another area of double talk from Netco, she was talking with Matt Allen about her, you'll hear her say the CBA, that's collective bargaining agreement, which is basically the contract. She wanted to emphasize it's a collective bargaining agreement. So it's over 40 or 50 years, however long it's been running, we've been unionized. This is our agreement. It's not a contract. A contract implies it can end. You know, never mind that state law limits contracts to 3 years. Anyway, but so here's Darlene Netco, the Warwick Union president, talking about the history of collective bargaining agreements in Warwick.
Problem in our current situation is that when our CBA expired in 2015, this current administration decided just to violate whole parts of it left and right. And, you know, going back to 1992, when the school committee did the same thing, we teachers ended up on strike. We ended up having to file an unfair labor practice, mm-hmm. and the Rhode Island State Labor Relations Board ruled at that time that the school committee had committed an unfair labor practice, that going forward, the terms and conditions of an expired collective bargaining agreement would remain in full force and effect until a successor agreement is reached. And that's the way, and by the way, it went to Superior Court, which kicked it back to the ruling, and then the Supreme Court of Rhode Island refused to hear it at the time. So that was the law of the land since 92.
Now, here's where I don't know if Matt wanted to get on to other topics or what, but this is really an area where the public needs to be have the record corrected. So she makes it sound like there was a court ruling, and it's obvious that the school committee is school district is administration is violating the play of the law. But that play of the law essentially changed in East Providence in 2008, 2009. There was a court ruling in 2010 giving East Providence the ability to change the terms of contracts in order to meet financial obligations when the contract had expired. This was filed in 2010. This, in case you're keeping score, is the whole reason the teachers' unions pushed for that evergreen contract legislation we've been hearing so much about that actually passed the General Assembly and then was vetoed and then was not, the veto was not overridden by the General Assembly. So it didn't become law. But that's the whole point of that, is to write it into law that these terms of these contracts must continue until there's a new negotiated settlement, which you can start to see why this is a problem, because the school administration is never free from the terms of the contract. There's never a really bullheaded union, like Warwick seems to have in some cases, could just hold off and never allow any adjustments downward. And they're going to keep getting paid, and all the terms will stay in place, and essentially, you know, put pressure and pressure on the school administration, particularly if they have budgetary issues they have to address, you know, with shrinking enrollment. So one thing that's funny here is Bob Walsh, the head of the National Education Association of Rhode Island, the biggest teachers union in the state. He, during the debate of the evergreen contract legislation, he kept saying, "Oh, well, this was settled law until the court just jumped in and changed it." And no, it wasn't. I mean, we're not talking like three centuries of common law here. In the 90s, a court said yes, you must follow the terms of this agreement. And then in the late zeros, another court said, okay, well, you don't always have to follow the terms of the contract. So if we were to have a reasonable discussion, you know, about this with interested parties coming together and, you know, talking about reality and trying to come to a good compromise that serves everybody's interests, you know, we might say, hey, maybe East Providence, the ruling there didn't change things from like a switch. It didn't go from contracts are forever to contracts are never forever. maybe what it did, which is what these courtroom rulings tend to do, is to better define when there's a controversy, they better define the boundaries. The people and the insiders and the labor unions and the people with political advantage like to ignore that because they like to have boundaries sort of mushy. So while they can control and they can sound all expert on the radio and they can, you know, have their political action outside off the screen, forcing committees or pressuring committees to do things that serve them and not the taxpayers. When the rules aren't defined, they can do that much better. So, but then when there's a controversy and somebody like the brave East Providence School Committee stands up to them, or it seems like Warwick School Committee and administration right now are doing to some extent, when they stand up and create this controversy, then courts step in and say, okay, here is the law. Let's look at this particular question on this narrow question. This is what the law says you have to do. So there, it's more like when you move to a new place and it's just blurry. You know, the map is ill-defined for you. You don't really have a sense of where things are relative to each other. And over time, it starts to fill in your mind. in your memory and your sense of your surroundings starts to fill in. That's what courts do. And that's what we ought to allow them to do and to that's what they do with the law, that is. And we ought to allow them to do that, and we ought to accept it and have reasonable conversations about what the play of the law really is. But we live in this lawyer-driven world where you can't do that because everybody's always jockeying for position, especially in Rhode Island, where the government has stepped in and created laws for everything and to protect insiders mainly. And therefore, they want it to seem like this abstract thing where they can just go out and say things and people kind of have to scratch their chins and say, oh, okay, well, you know what you're talking about better than I do, so I guess that's what it is. It's not a healthy thing. And part of what's contributing to this whole kind of approach in our society right now is the partisan nature of everything, the ideological nature of everything, how the left took over cultural institutions and everything's politicized. Everything has what determines what's presented, reported, explained, very often seems to be just what political party it serves, or more appropriately, what ideology it serves. I was thinking about this yesterday. President Trump has put out, I think, one yesterday, one today, executive orders on Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, health care in America. And yesterday, the Washington Post published a report from reporter Amy Goldstein, which it comes through I get an RSS feed, and so I get the original versions that are posted. And it's often very funny. Like today, WPRI had a headline. I said, police confiscate dog after biting woman, which, you know, grammatically means the police bit the woman and then took the dog, which is hilarious. You know, if you're, you know, like a language nerd type of guy like me, which I am because I'm me. But so I get the original versions of things that appear in, say, the Providence Journal. And this Amy Goldstein Washington Post piece on Trump's Obamacare executive order came out. And I thought about writing on it. And then I thought, you know, yesterday afternoon, I just thought, you know what, this is not even interesting anymore. There's just the bias. But I wrote about it today because the Providence Journal, first in the print edition, they published a diluted version of it, and then they disappeared the online version. So I actually had to go back and find a cached version, and it confirmed that it was actually the Washington Post original, maybe with some editorial changes, but not a lot. But I'm going to read this and just listen to it, and I won't allow you to miss the parts that are suspect. So this is Amy Goldstein writing for the Washington Post. The White House and allies portray the president's move to expand access to association health plans as wielding administrative powers to accomplish what congressional Republicans have failed to achieve, tearing down the law's insurance marketplaces and letting Americans buy skimpier coverage at lower prices. The order is Trump's biggest step to carry out a broad but ill-defined directive he issued his first night in office for agencies to lessen ACA regulations from the Obama administration. Now, there's no way, this is me talking again, there's no way to miss what this woman, this reporter, Amy Goldstein, wants you to feel about this. Skimpier coverage, ill-defined, tearing down insurance marketplaces. You're supposed to think this is outrageous, right? She goes on to offer some facts about it, but only after having offered this editorial comment, and then a big chunk of her article is about the opposition and what their point is, not at all with this language, but as with language indicating that this is the truth. And then she gives some details. That's not how all of this is supposed to work. This is not how we let the public know what's going on in our society. And then today, so yesterday was about these association health plans, which strike me as being a very, very good idea. But today, the president ended some subsidies that help lower premiums for some customers. That is, in other words, they subsidize the insurance companies to charge higher premiums that poorer people don't actually have to pay. And again, the news media is all out there with their hair on fire The Associated Press reporter Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar, he called it a brash move. But if you look into it, this is a policy the Obama administration unilaterally started issuing these subsidies, and the Congress, that's the legislature. So the president is one branch of government of three, in case you skipped that day in civics. The executive branch, the president, issued these subsidies. The legislature, that's Congress, said, hey, you have no authority to do that. So the legislature, another branch of Congress, supposed to be, I think, the highest, the one that makes the laws because it's more broadly representative, they said no. So now we've got a disagreement between two branches of government. So they turned to the third branch of government, the judiciary. And the judiciary said, no, executive, no, Obama, you cannot do this. So two branches of government had told the executive branch, you cannot unilaterally create these subsidies. And yet they continued until just now. And the reporting is that it's a brash move to take them away. It's a brash move to comply with the law. That's just not how it ought to be presented. But again, the idea isn't to convey information. The idea is to tell people how they're supposed to feel about this political action. And one quick small one, because I don't want to get into it too much, that illustrates the point as well, is right after the shooting in Las Vegas, Hillary Clinton, whom, for all his faults, we must thank Donald Trump for saving us as the president, as becoming the president. Hillary Clinton comes out after this atrocity pretty quickly and says, tries to tie it to a political agenda about silencers, which are misnamed as silencers. They're actually suppressors. And what makes this such a great example for my topic here is that, I mean, I remember when I was a kid watching movies and the guy's running around with the silencer and when you shoot somebody, it goes, vzz. That wasn't very good. I'm not a sound guy. Or, and I mean, that's it. Like a whisper. That's your silencer. Firing a gun. That's what silencers do. That's the impression people have. It's just not true. It's like a jackhammer. So instead of, I'm not going to blow your ears out, but instead of this loud, there's a slightly less loud. Have you ever heard a jackhammer? Have you ever been walking around, say, New York City or anywhere, and somebody in the distance is jackhammering? It's not quiet. You would still notice this sound that sounds like a gunshot, but quieter, going on and on and on. Somebody who's a politician, who is almost president, who wants to be involved in the public debate to the point of releasing press releases that are going to be covered around the country and maybe the world, ought to know that that's not true. And probably does. So as I started out with my intro, this falsity and truth, so we're sort of the same topic, but kind of a different vein of it. The Boy Scouts of America have announced that they will now take girls. They're going to have, they'll technically be separate dens. So there'll be the Boy Scout, the boy den, and the girl den, presumably meeting at the same time because we're talking local organizations usually, and doing all the same things. And it made me think back to my experience as a child because I was a Boy Scout. And when I started in Cub Scouts, my mother was very involved with it. And so I stuck with it through Cub Scouts for that reason partly, and then got to Boy Scouts. And the reality was I didn't much like the camping component. In the winter, it was just not comfortable. And I had, not, I don't want to say a fear, but wild animals unnerved me, particularly if they could, you know, bite you or spray you and make you stink really bad. I mean, there was one time I was in a tent at Boy Scout camp, and all of the tents were put up on sort of wooden pallets, and I believe a skunk had snuck crawled into it and was climbing through it, and I kind of freaked out and jumped out of the tent. And there was another time I'll never forget. Was we were actually in a cabin, and I was a little boy here, so forgive me. You know, it's a silly story. And I hear this noise and scurrying in the cabin as if some animal had come in, and it went to my bed, and I was all nervous, or caught more appropriately. And then I felt weight on my back and something trying to get into my sleeping bag. It turned out to be my dad had gone out to use the bush, the men's bush. And that doesn't sound very good. And so he wanted to see if I needed to go while he was up. But that's the kind of uncomfortableness I had with kind of wild animals. I might go back, might have been in my apartment complex, very relatively urban apartment complex in New Jersey, suburban New Jersey. And there were always raccoons in the dumpsters at night if I would go out to throw out garbage, and they would freak me out. And they'd just run into the sewer real quick as you approached, and it was kind of scary for a boy, a little boy. So I, you know, that was kind of, and I had heard of rabid raccoons and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I didn't much like the camping experience. When I got old enough that I started to have to be in charge, I was no good at that. I would assign jobs, as I had been told to do. You will scrub the pot. And the kid would just ignore me and go play with his friends. And so I would just do it. And I didn't like that. And I never, you know, looking back, I kind of wish my parents had forced me to stick with it. And maybe I would have been forced to ask somebody for tips on how to get people to do things. And I would have found that missing ingredient, fixing something that I was getting wrong. I think instead I ended up, you know, much more wallowing in whatever that was making me get it wrong. And things didn't go so well through the next few years. But, you know, hey, the summer camp was kind of fun. We went to the summer camp, the Boy Scout camp, where they filmed Friday the 13th. It wasn't called Crystal Lake, obviously. So that was kind of spooky. Then in the, what do they call it, the canteen, the little store, they actually had the sign Camp Crystal Lake. And kids who had, for some reason at that young age, seen the movie would say, oh, this is where this happens and this is where that happened. So that was kind of fun too. But I did the Boy Scouting thing, and frankly, I wish I'd done more of it and deliberately gotten more out of it. I got a good bit out of it, but I wish I'd followed it through. But what strikes me here, and what I wrote about was today on the Ocean State Current was, well, first of all, the story on WPRI to the local angle to the story, the female reporter goes out and asks the Girl Scouts what they think of the Boy Scouts accepting girls, which seemed like, I don't know, it seemed to reinforce the idea that only one party is important in this equation. And the Girl Scout head, and I didn't write it down, so I don't have it in front of me, for the Girl Scout leader for this region said, well, no, we believe that girls need a safe space to be away from boys, to learn how to be leaders and as young girls and women. And you know, it's fine for, I don't, you know, I support families who want to put their girls in the Boy Scouts too, of course. But we just, our mission is to develop girls into women. And it seemed to me that maybe boys need an organization whose mission is to develop boys into men. I mean, that doesn't seem like too much to want. And that it was implicit in this, that the woman wasn't criticizing the Boy Scouts for depriving boys of that or moving away from their own mission. She was just saying, no, we want to support girls. It's fine for girls to have their own space. You know, I've thought about signing up my son for Boy Scouts. It's usually in the context of, wanting to find some place in this society where, you know, he can just be a boy and have some guidance on what that means and activities that traditionally and not for no reason have been kind of boyish things that help you become a man. But if it's not that, if it's not going to be that, if it's just going to be another activity, another set of activities, some of which, you know, frankly, I didn't like when I was a kid, and I don't know if my son would, but, you know, we don't lack for options when it comes to activities for our children, boys or girls. We are actively sorting through the possibilities to limit them, because we just can't do it all. You know, there are co-ed sleepaway camps already. If camp is the summer camp, going out in the woods or whatever is the thing that you want, then, you know, those things exist without being Boy Scouts. So there's no, we'll pick one that's closer or has this. Myself, after the Boy Scout thing, I went to piano camp. It was a sleepaway piano camp in Vermont. Of course, that dynamic, the co-ed piano camp in Vermont, was part of my problem. I kind of might have been better off going to all boys camps for that part of my life. But, you know, it makes me wonder. So we're getting this. We're losing sight of what Boy Scouts are supposed to do, and I can understand that their participation is going down, probably because, you know, given the option, given other things that kids can do these days, going out in the woods. Maybe I'm not alone and not liking it so much. But you know, I'm wondering, from the Boy Scouts' perspective, what are there more of? Are there more parents like me who's essentially, this is my father is a Boy Scout. I don't know I don't know if my grandfather, if it was around back then, but Boy Scouts is kind of like a generational tradition in my family, and which we're breaking. And so I wonder if there are more parents like me where our families have kind of drifted away from Scouts, but maybe we feel like we're shorting our children on something of that fundamental mission. Or are there more parents who've eschewed the Boy Scouts because it was just too much about boys? And, you know, I tend to think that strategically trying to shore up your role in our society is a stronger position, a better decision than trying to dilute it. And that, you know, that assumes that this is being done as a means of increasing participation, and I don't think that at all. I think the left, not that there's a secret cabal, but there are certainly at least a handful of billionaire funders willing to put some money into going after the Boy Scouts, and then this sort of disaggregated collective Borg mind of progressives have targeted Boy Scouts for a long time, as they have all traditional organizations and organizations that support any kind of traditional understanding of humanity. I think they're just pushing it. They're just pushing it over the edge. And the people who make decisions are involved in their socioeconomic classes have been basically brainwashed to do the virtue signaling thing through college, their Ivy League schools or what have you. And that's, you know, filtered down now to where they're making decisions that really don't reflect what people want or need, but more reflect what the elite folks think their friends want them to do. And, you know, that's a shame. But, you know, hopefully something will spring up to replace what we're destroying. And I can only hope that we don't fall apart as a society too much before that thing rejuvenates itself. And one thing's for sure, though, that honesty about all these, honest discussion, forthright discussion about real differences, about real facts, about real power dynamics, that's going to be essential. And we have to find some way to teach each other that and to instill in our children the importance of maintaining that kind of attitude. And it's a shame that we're losing social help institutional help in doing that. But if you want to help support institutional an institution, I guess, such as it is, that's trying to do some of that stuff, go to iTunes, find this there, and subscribe, leave comments and lots of stars. Go to Ricochet if you're a member and like this post, and it'll be kind of ramped up on that site. You know, you can go to the Ocean State Current, leave comments. We're always looking for feedback and advertisers or what have you. And until next week, remember, don't worry so much about first impressions, because you can fix them. It's the last impressions. They can follow you for an eternity. God bless you.